is best, even if it seems silly to them, and the focus of our study is on Naaman. So if you want to turn to 2 Kings chapter 5, we'll spend most of our time there. It's not a long passage, but it's one of the ones that is preached about quite often, and one of the better lessons that we can have to understand how that our thinking sometimes is not as God thinks. God's thoughts are higher than ours. Our ways are higher. His ways are higher than ours, Isaiah tells us. So let's not be tricking ourselves to think that we sometimes know best as opposed to what God has said. But the psalm that is used is Psalm 119, and the verse is 71, and it's a good psalm, good verse. The writer says, "It is good for me that I have been afflicted, that I may learn your statutes." Most of us do not want to be afflicted, but there are lessons that come from our afflictions, and that's what the psalmist said as he looked back. Not maybe in the very present moment of that affliction, but as he reflected upon it, he thought, "I learned some lessons. It was good for me. I suffered. I understand other people's suffering. I sympathize. I really, really, you know, have made some progress, even though I've been afflicted, maybe physically or emotionally some way, but yet it has strengthened me to lean more upon my God." The story, 2 Kings chapter 5, has several characters. Naaman, he comes in contact with a servant girl who had been taken captive, and then his servants go with him as he is sent by the king of Israel to by the king of Syria to the king of Israel. And finally, he does meet Elisha, or he really never meets Elisha. We can put it that way. He never really meets him. But if you look there in chapter 5, the first verse, we're told that Naaman is commander of the army of the king of Syria. He was a great man with his master and in high favor. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Because by him, the Lord had given victory to Syria. Now, that's one way that the Israelites were sometimes afflicted. When they disobeyed God, they were allowed to be conquered, or some of their people were taken captive by some of the surrounding nations, and Syria is a surrounding nation. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. Now, let's just talk a little bit briefly about leprosy. If you want to read in detail, in the book of Leviticus, chapter 13 and 14, there is a great deal of information about leprosy. It's a skin disease. It causes deformations. It's also a nerve disease, I understand that. And leprosy is not common in this country. Very rarely do you hear of a leper. And worldwide, the numbers are down significantly, I've read, but it is a most painful, obviously, and anytime our skin is not how we'd like it. Look at the industry on skin products. I mean, it is tremendous ways to keep our skin looking good and healthy. Well, here's a man who is commander of the army, and he probably feels terrible every day. Not only does he look the part of a leper, and leprosy is associated with snow. There's an Old Testament lady who was stricken with leprosy. Do you remember who she was? Very famous lady. Miriam. Because she and Aaron kind of disagreed with why the Lord was using Moses so much more than them. And for about a week, she was out of the camp. When you had leprosy, you had to leave the camp. You were unclean, and that simply meant you couldn't take part in the day-to-day activities and the worship and the sacrifice, all of that. You were an outcast for a brief period of time, or as long as you had leprosy. Not incurable, because in Leviticus 13 and 14, when you were suspected of having leprosy, you were to go to the priest. Now, the priest were the ones who determined whether you could be in the camp or out of the camp. And they had certain tests. Then you can again read this in Leviticus 13 and 14, and they would determine whether you were able to take part, come back into the camp, or if you were an outcast, you were considered unclean. Well, this man is suffering, no doubt, terribly. And to what lengths do we go to when we're suffering? Just about anything. We try just about anything. Anytime our bodies are hurting, we're suffering, and somebody says, well, you know, there's a promise of a healing over there. Well, that's why a lot of people go and seek out a doctor, maybe far away from where they are. Or they will seek out a faith healer because they have been told or led to believe that somehow there is a power there. So, this man, James, did you have a comment?
That received to me is like hives, okay? Because it just forms your skin, your mouth, your eyes, a whole lot of places on your body.
Right.
Because, see, I have eyes and nose. And so they give me this medicine that I take every day for this condition that ants actually cause me to have bad nerves and makes my hands shake sometimes. So it's basically, you know, I can't go around. If I don't take this medicine and this stuff comes out, it's basically a form of not looking good, and people get a tendency to actually
see it
the wrong way.
Yeah, it's a good point. It is a very severe skin disease, and it affects the nerves and eyes and nose. I have read, but I've seen pictures of people who have leprosy, and it's, you know, shingles is something that we get when we get older sometimes, very painful. Yes. So this man, for all of that he has, he is troubled greatly, greatly troubled. There is no cure that he can find, but he has been given hope because the Syrians, in one of their raids, have captured a little girl from the land of Israel, and she works for Naaman's wife. And she says to her mistress, "Would that my lord would have the prophet who is in Samaria. He will cure him of his leprosy." Here's hope. It's 100 miles away. If he's in Damascus, which is probably 100, maybe a little over 100 miles from Samaria. I don't know what part of Samaria exactly Elisha is in. But anyway, there is hope. And when we have hope, that's a great thing. Up to this point, there is no indication that he thought he'd ever be cured of his leprosy. So he goes to the king of Syria, and the king, who obviously favors him greatly, says, "Go, and I'll give you a letter, and go to the king of Israel." And he took a large sum of money. He took 10 talents of silver, 60,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothing. So he brought gifts to pay if he was cured. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel. Now, the king of Israel, at this point, this is a few years after Ahab, who we studied last week. One of his sons is the king of Israel. And he follows in his father's footsteps. He's not a godly man at all, from what we read. And so, when he is told in this letter that he's supposed to cure this man, what's his reaction?
Well, he's required. He's going to require this. And, you know, I've got to. He's like a double-edged sword. He's going to be all the bad end of it if he can't get.
Yeah, he tore his clothes. Said, "Am I God? Am I God that I can heal somebody? To kill and make alive and secure this man of leprosy?" He thought the king was seeking a quarrel. He could come and, you know, have another battle with him, another war with him. Elijah has ascended to heaven at this time. He is not in the picture anymore, but there's a new prophet. Who's the new prophet?
Elisha.
Elisha is the prophet that most recognized now. And so Elisha hears. Elisha is described as the man of God in verse 8. That the king of Israel tore his clothes, and he sent to the king saying, "Why have you torn your clothes?" Now, keep me up, Tom. And so this is what he says. send him to me. Let him know that there is a prophet in Israel. And so Naaman, and he comes with all of those who are with him, his horses, his chariots, and obviously his servants, and whoever travels with him. It must have been a pretty large group. And they come to the door of Elisha's house. And so here are this man who is seeking cure, and he comes to this prophet. And does Elisha come out to meet him? No, he does not even come out to meet him. And as Elisha is inside of the house, he sent a messenger. And that, who would the messenger be from what we read in the rest of the passage? Gehazi. Yes, he's his Elisha's servant. And I'm assuming he's the messenger who comes out, and it's a very simple message. What was the simple message? Go dip in the Jordan River 7 times, and if you do that, your flesh will be restored and you shall be clean. In other words, your skin will be as such as a little child's skin, just as smooth as can be. That sounds fairly simple, doesn't it? It sounds simple. They probably weren't too far from the Jordan River. I don't have a map up exactly, but it's not far. But Naaman's reaction is what? He is angry, he is furious, he went away, he just kind of walked away or sped away, whatever he did. And he said, "Behold, I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place and cure the leprosy." And then he talked about the Abanon and the Pharpar River of Damascus. They were better than all the waters of Israel. Could I not wash in them and be clean? And he turned and went away in a rage. Now, I tell you, sometimes we get angry. We get angry to the point that we cannot be reasoned with. We cannot see beyond that very moment. And somebody told you, you know, Hinkston Creek, right behind us. Growing up, there was a nickname for Hinkston. Anybody remember? Hinkston Stinkston or something. It was like that. It was just polluted. That's probably like what they thought the Jordan was like. Just a nasty place. Dirty in some areas. So his hope is gone, almost, except for what? His servants, they are voices of reason in a time of anger and a time of blind rage. And he said, "My father, it is a great word the prophet has spoken to you. Will you not do it? Has he actually said to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" Now that's where we need people around us who can keep their heads and listen and focus and see beyond what at this point Naaman was able to envision, because he had come with his own idea about how he was going to be cured. Just like people today may go to a doctor or someplace and think, "Well, you know, the doctor's going to have me take a test or give me a pill or a shot and I'll be cured." Well, it doesn't work that way a lot of times. You know, and we cannot play doctor, although we try sometimes. Because of all the information that's out there on the internet, instead of going to the doctor, I'm going to go to the internet. And I'm going to see my symptoms and I'm going to say, "Well, what do they say here?" Well, Naaman didn't have that luxury, obviously. But what he did was actually do what the prophet said. And he went down and dipped 7 times in the Jordan according to the word of the man of God, and his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. What a marvelous story. What a marvelous story of simplicity, following God's commandments, believing enough to obey. And it must have been quite a sight to see this great man. And he was a great man from all we read, humbling himself, going into this river, dirty river, at least in his mind, and dipping 7 times. And then coming up the 7th time, and just as the prophet had said, just as God had said, he would be clean. And what a marvelous ending. But the story doesn't end there. And although in our lesson it ends there, let's just go on and read a little bit more in the chapter. And I hope you did, because there are some good lessons in the rest of the chapter. He returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and he came and stood before him. Now, he does meet the man of God now. Okay, he had not come out. Remember, he'd sent his servant out or his messenger out. But he said, "Behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. So accept now a present from your servant." But he said, "As the Lord lives before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he urged him to take it, but he refused. So Elisha accepts nothing of all the gold, silver, garments he's brought. He will accept nothing. And that puzzles Naaman, as it would have puzzled us. If you'd been cured by a doctor from a supposedly incurable disease, or one that you knew no answer, and he refused to accept payment, what would you think? Anyway, he does have one request, though. One more request that Naaman makes. He wants to take some 2 loads of dirt, put on a mule. Odd kind of it sounds to us. Naaman said, "If not, please be given to your servant 2 mules loads of earth, for from now on your servant will not offer burnt offerings or sacrifice to any god but the Lord." So what's he going to do with this earth, this ground that he is asking to be loaded up and put on 2 mules? What's he going to do with it when he gets home? Going to build either an altar, or he's going to offer sacrifices on this particular ground? Now, he doesn't know anything much about Jehovah. He just recognizes his power. And he wants to honor him in his own way, in the only way he can think of. And this is his thinking. Elisha does not recommend that to him. But he asked for this. And then he has another request. "In this manner may the Lord pardon your servant when my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm and bow myself in the house of Rimmon. And I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. The Lord pardon your servant in this matter." And Elisha says to him, "Go in peace." So he has 2 requests. One, that he be able to take this earth from this particular area, this dirt. And he knows that when he gets back home, his master's going to want him to continue, as he has in the past, to go with him to the house of their God, and to go with him and to bow down to their God. And he asks that if the Lord would pardon him in this matter. Elisha does not particularly answer yes or no that the Lord will pardon him. He just says, "Go in peace." So Naaman is going home. And then he says he goes a short distance. And then something happens. Who enters the picture now? All right. The servant, Gehazi, enters the picture now. And he, well, we're going to see what happens. But anyway, Naaman says, "Is anything wrong?" And, well, really there's nothing wrong, but he said, "I'm going to run after this man as the Lord lives, and I will get something from him." Gehazi sees all this gold and silver and all these clothing just going back to Syria. And he feels that it should be here. After all, they earned it. They earned it because they cured him, in his thinking, maybe. And Naaman, when he sees him coming, he says, "Is all well?" And he said, "Well, all is well, but my master has sent me to say that two young prophets have come. And please give them a talent of silver and two festive garments." Well, Naaman is more than happy to do that because he is able to repay, at least in his thinking, for what has taken place and happened to him. And he says, "Please accept two talents." And he urged him and tied up two talents of silver and two bags with two festive garments and laid them on two of his servants. And they carried them before Gehazi. And when he came to the hill, he took them from their hand and put them in the house. And he sent the men away and they departed. All right, so he's taken them, but he's not going to tell Elisha about this. And Elisha's not going to know anything about it because he puts them someplace else. He hides them. And he sends the servants away. So Elisha is unaware of what's going on, at least he thinks. And all seems to be okay. He's going to profit from this. But he does have to go and stand before his master there in verse 25 of 2 Kings 5. And Elisha says, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" And he says, "Well, your servant's been nowhere." But this is what is told. Elisha says to him, "Did not my heart go when the man turned from his chariot to meet you? Was it a time to accept money and garments, olive orchards, vineyards, sheep, oxen, male servants, and female servants? Therefore, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and your descendants forever." So he went out from his presence, a leper like snow. Well, a little twist to the story there as we read it. So let's just consider a little bit as we're looking and thinking about this. What was Gehazi's desire? And this is just a few of the questions we're going to look at. What did he want? All right. He felt they deserved it, I believe. And he was willing to lie to get it. Okay. Do you think he ever dreamed that he would be punished as he was? No. He knew what leprosy was. He knew what Naaman had been suffering. He'd seen other lepers because the Bible says there were many lepers in Israel at the same time Naaman suffered. And this is what we read in the book of Luke. The question that I want to think about there, what does God ask of us that would lead us to respond as Naaman did to Elisha's instructions? What does God ask of us, and we would respond much as Naaman responded? Okay. All right. I would sum all that up from what we read in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Naaman thought it was foolish to go and dip in the Jordan River 7 times. He could see no connection between a skin disease that was probably covering most of his body and was causing him severe pain and anxiety and going and dipping in a river that was unclean. Do you have a point, Kate?
John baptized Jesus in Jordan.
True. He did. That's right.
I think baptism, the way people look at it today, baptism, a lot of people look at it
way. Well, how is that, or why do I need
to do that, as opposed to just having faith, or something along those lines?
That's a good point.
We're just like Naaman in our human aspect. We think that we have to do some great, powerful, wondrous, miraculous looking thing. God makes it simple, but we, in our minds, we can't fathom that. We think it has to be something that's just out of this world.
Well, God said that you must be baptized in order to get yourself to eternal heaven. So a lot of people don't understand that, which a lot of them probably never will. But when Jesus came and committed the ultimate sacrifice for our life, it said, behold, you must be cleansed. So you must go down in front of the water and be baptized. And so a lot of people don't see it that way, but that's what it takes.
A lot of people cannot see the dipping in this water will somehow change them and their sins will be washed away. They cannot see that obedience to God's commandment to be born again of water and the Spirit, especially the water, they cannot make a connection between that and the forgiveness of sins, although it's clearly taught in the New Testament. But my point would be this. If you look in 1 Corinthians 1, the whole idea is foolish. The message of the cross is foolish. It's just foolish, Paul said. If you look with me in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, we could begin in 18. For the word of the cross is folly to those who are perishing, to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. He goes on to talk about the wisdom of this world. Where is the wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater? Has God not made foolish the wisdom of the world? Now, verse 23. We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews, and folly to the Gentiles. For those who are being saved, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. And you can read all down through this. If you go over to chapter 2 of this 1 Corinthians, it says in verse 14, the natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are folly to him, and he is not able to understand them because they are spiritually discerned. Now, we'll look at that just for a moment. To be foolish means to be, well, there's several definitions. Lacking of common sense, a lot of people would say, you're a fool. You lack reason. You are stupid. It makes no sense. What you're doing is just crazy. It's ridiculous. We would never do that. Or we would think anybody doing that would be a foolish person. The opposite of fool would be wise person. Okay? Now, you know, Jesus dealt with lepers, didn't he? He dealt with them on several occasions. He went to a man's house, Simon the leper. He was met by 10 lepers in the book of Luke in chapter 17. And these lepers were afar off. They couldn't come close. And they were unclean. And they had to cry out, unclean. So you know not to get too close to them. Although, from what I read, leprosy is not especially contagious unless you have very close contact with a person and you breathe the air that they're breathing. But so you would stay away for safety's sake. And Jesus cleansed 10 lepers, and what happened? Yeah, they were all clean. He said, go show yourself to the priest. And of course, the priest still had to say you were clean in order to get back into the society, into the community. And so one, as you said, came back, and Jesus said, well, we're not 10 cleansed, where are the 9? And that's been the source of a lot of good sermons. Where are the 9 that have been cleansed? Now, when Naaman got back to Syria, what was he going to face?
He was going to be faced with bowing down to God.
That's right. He's going to face it. Now, the one thing that I haven't brought up or thought about, when he came back to Syria, he was cured. He was cleansed. You think that got some of the Syrians thinking about, and he probably explained to them what happened? You think some of them may have kind of softened their stance about, you know, maybe our God's not the great God in the house of Rimmon? That's not the place to be, because here's a man who can give testimony of what happened when he went to Israel and was cured. by the true and living God through his prophet Elisha's words and his obedience to those words. So that does make a difference, but yet he knew, and as you pointed out, Donnie, he knew that he would have to go with his master and worship at the place falsely, obviously, now that he knew more of the truth. But he asked that the Lord do what? Pardon me, forgive me. Now, what does Elisha say? Does he answer that God will forgive him? Does he specifically say that? He simply says, go in peace. Leaving it to whom?
To
leaving it to Naaman, I believe. Now, this is kind of goes with this next question. Does God give us time or space to untangle ourselves from our world?
Yes.
Does he do that?
All
right, we're not to be entangled in the affairs of this world. That's what Timothy said, or Paul tells Timothy, 2 Timothy 2, verse 4. Don't be entangled, caught up in, to the point that it does what? Because if you look over with me over there, we'll kind of look at a little bit more of the verse there in 2 Timothy, where he tells him that he is now a soldier of the Lord. 2 Timothy 2, and verse 4, no soldier entangled in civilian pursuits, since his aim is to please the one who enlisted him. So, the illustration, he says, is a soldier. Now, some of you, James has been in the military, Greg's been in the military, maybe some others. When you enter into this service, you're not free to do as you formerly did. You're now under a new system, a new order with new rules and new commanders, and you are to be obedient, and if you're not, then you get in trouble. Yeah. So, who is Naaman now? And I find him as an interesting character here. As to, we're not told what happens. This is the last we have of him. But from his character, from what we read, because what kind of man is Naaman?
He is a man of valor.
He is a mighty man of valor. I believe he's just he's a very good man. He just seems to be one of those Gentiles who, outside of the law of Moses and outside of the understanding the Israelites had, still has this conscience and this awareness about him and the world around him, that he can see things in a spiritual sense, because that is why we are different than those in the world, in the sense that I was reading about the famous scientist Stephen Hawking, who just passed away last month. He wrote A Brief History of Time, and he was the most famous scientist probably living in the world when he died. He was a theoretical physicist. He studied black holes and cosmos and the universe, and he thought he knew how the world began even before the Big Bang theory, which was is the scientific model of how creation came about. He could go back in his own mind before that. He thought there has always been time, and I've read several things about him. He says, God may exist, but science can explain the universe without the need for a creator. And this is held by a lot of people who we would say are wise in the ways of this world. Their IQs are way up there. They have spent their life learning. Now, Paul talked about people who are learning but never coming to a knowledge of the truth. Their idea of learning may be a little bit different than ours. They believe that the answers lie in science, not in God's Word, but they're looking at an alternative. And therefore, you have, if you see them side by side, the ideas of the Bible on one side and the latest theories of men on the other side, they are very much in conflict with one another. It was interesting, I thought, I've read that Stephen Hawking was an unbeliever. I wouldn't go so far to say he was a complete atheist. But I found it interesting that at his funeral, they read from the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verses 1 through 11, the wisdom of Solomon, there is a time for everything under the heavens. Interesting. I thought, here's somebody who has professed no faith, and yet at the funeral, where do they go for words of comfort or consolation or explanation? They go to God's Word. And I thought that was interesting. Ironic, but interesting. Because deep down in most people, even the most pronounced atheists that I have read about, there's that little tinge of doubt in there, that little part of conscience that says, you know, God has placed eternity in our hearts. Somebody did that, and it wasn't the Big Bang that did it. God did it. Yeah. Is that the second bell?
That's the second.